For the week of November 14th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 79, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And just back from the North American Harry Potter world premiere, I'm Michael Giltz.
How was it?
It was exciting. I was on the red carpet, or I should say the black carpet, because it was black emblazoned with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. There were tons of celebrities there. I was working the thing. I didn't actually see the movie because I didn't have time. But, you know, there were the stars of the film. There were other celebrities like Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick and this person and that person, skater Johnny Weir. You know who the red carpet people got the most excited about?
Who?
Darren Criss from Glee, the new guy who might be Kurt's boyfriend. We're all like, is that Darren Criss? Is that Darren Criss?
Oh, that's so cool.
Everybody was in a tizzy over him, and he was working the line hard. He was working it. He was making the most of his night.
You know, they just made him a series regular, I read.
Yeah, yeah.
What's Glee again? I'm just kidding.
Anyway, that was my night last night.
Well, it sounds like you had a busy night, and it's been a busy week in the entertainment world. There seems to be a ton of news over the past couple of weeks to fill you in on, and this week is no exception. In movie headlines, we'll discuss the passing of legendary producer Dino De Laurentiis, and I'm sure I just mispronounced that name. I don't know why. Our guest this week is Joe Fleischer, the chief marketing officer of Big Champagne, the company that is taking on Billboard and SoundScan with the Ultimate Chart, which is a whole new way of measuring music. There's television news and book news, and of course we'll cover all the big news stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop. How many bigs can I put into one sentence? That's what that last sentence was. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And of course, the number one movie at the box office for the second weekend in a row is the DreamWorks animated film Megamind, starring the voices of Will Ferrell, who Forbes.com said last week was one of the most overpaid actors in Hollywood. It grossed $30.5 million. It's at $89 million total. Number two is Unstoppable, the runaway train film starring Denzel Washington and Chris Pine. It grossed $23 million, and it is the eighth big film in a row of Denzel Washington to open at $20 million or higher. That is a movie star. Number three is Due Date, the road trip comedy with Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis. That grossed $15.5 million. It's at just about $60 million total. And number four is Skyline, the somewhat low-budget alien invasion flick that was highly touted to open to maybe $30, $35 million. It opened dead in the water, really, at $11.6 million. But wait, it only cost $10 million to wake, so that's actually not so bad. At number five is Morning Glory, which was the real bomb of the week. That's the romantic comedy, broadcast newsy type film starring Harrison Ford, Diane Keaton, and Rachel McAdams. It grossed $9.6 million, $12 million since its Wednesday opening. That's on a very low budget, apparently, of $40 million, which I can't imagine. That doesn't make any sense. I'm sure it costs more than that. At number six is the Tyler Perry film For Colored Girls. That dropped heavily from last week, a 65% drop. That's big even for a Tyler Perry film. And it's grossed $30 million total. At number seven is Red, still showing some pretty good legs. Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren's action comedy. That's at $80 million total. And then the last few, $3 million and $2 million each. Paranormal Activity 2, that's at $82 million total. Saw 3D at $43 million total, and Jackass 3D, which grossed $114 million and counting. But that wasn't the biggest entertainment event of the weekend. What was the biggest entertainment event of the weekend? A video game. The biggest news was not at the movie box office. It was at the video game stores, where Call of Duty Black Ops opened in the U.S. and the U.K. on Tuesday. It grossed $360 million in one day. And that topped the previous record of $310 million. In its first 5 days of release in just two markets worldwide, it grossed $550 million. It's hard to get the figures, but that's probably bigger than any movie has ever done in their first 5 days in history.
Well, of course, it beat out Modern Warfare 2, which was last year's big blockbuster $310 million grossing in one day video game. But really, 5.6 million copies in 24 hours, that is a lot of copies. And, you know, there's no taking away from that. But remember, the dollar figure here, it's $60 per video game. So
what? If you could charge $100 for a film ticket and people would pay it,
but they
who cares?
But they wouldn't. And I guess what I'm saying is the number one movie at the box office probably had more people go see it than purchased in one day Call of Duty 2 Black Ops.
I'm not sure I would agree with that.
Ooh, say, do say.
Well, I have no numbers to back it up, but I do think that, and I was surprised, right? I do think that there are, I've always felt that video games are they don't have the respect that they deserve, but I think that they sell more than people think, and I think that every time something like this happens and it makes a ton of money, that people in the movie business always dismiss it somehow.
Yeah, they want to downplay it. They're afraid of it.
Right.
And you got to think, when somebody buys a video game, a lot of times a couple friends probably come over. It's not like one movie ticket. You buy one video game, two or three or four friends might come over and play it.
Right. Well, and a movie is a 2 or 3 hour experience, whereas a video game, I mean, that could be an entire weekend experience. I mean, that's
yeah, yeah, you can spend 20, 30, 40 hours completing a game, depending on the level of the game and how you power through it. So, yeah, you're paying $60, but you're also devoting 3 or 4 days or a week of your time to experiencing it as opposed to 2 hours in a theater. So, you know, any way you slice it, the fact that it can gross $550 million in 5 days, that's bigger than any film has probably ever done. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince grossed $394 million on its first 3 days. Spider-Man 3 was the second one that grossed $381 million worldwide. And Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, $344 million. So they're pretty equivalent. And obviously the movies have much bigger legs. You know, the Call of Duty Black Ops is more front-loaded than a Tyler Perry film. Let's put it that way.
I know Tyler Perry's film dropped off 65.4%. That's Four Colored Girls, the Lionsgate release.
Well, it didn't get very good reviews.
No, none of his movies ever do. It's also a very difficult play. It's sort of an avant-garde play without much of a plot. So it was a hard one to turn into a film in the first place. But I'm sure he was hoping for a little more prestige, I guess, and maybe an Oscar for somebody, an Oscar nomination for one of his actors. But, you know, it cost $21 million to make. It's made $30 million total. You know, he'll go right back to Madea on his next film and everybody will be happy.
And Due Date dropped 52.5%.
$60 million total. I think that's pretty good. It's a two-guy road comedy.
I saw Morning Glory.
What did you think of Morning Glory? I really enjoyed that film.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, and the reviews that I'm reading are not great, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great movie. Have we seen it before? Kind of. You know, every romantic comedy is sort of like that.
Romantic? But, where's the romance? I mean, it's barely a romantic comedy.
Yeah, that's actually
basically a comedy. It's a workplace comedy.
Yes, because there is, you're absolutely right. They try to sneak in some romance, but really there's no romance in that movie whatsoever.
So you two guys are going to lay your money down, and this is an adult film that audiences won't flock to necessarily on opening weekend. You think the word of mouth will be good, and then next weekend we can look to a pretty good hold for Morning Glory, and that should show some good legs and build an audience over the next 3 or 4 weeks.
I don't know, because Harry Potter opens up next weekend, and I think that the audience that sees Morning Glory is also going to see Harry Potter.
Isn't that not the same audience at all?
No, that audience, believe it or not, has children that will go see Harry Potter. The parents might want to go see Morning Glory, and they very well might while they send their kids off to see Harry Potter. And
see, I think there are just as many parents who want to see Harry Potter for themselves.
You're right. Everybody will see Harry Potter, but I think the adults that were go
I
to Morning Glory.
Yet, you know, I actually have something to confess. I did not see the last Harry Potter film.
You're a terrible person.
I've got a worse confession. I hate Harry Potter. I couldn't get through the first book.
Okay, the books are actually pretty good. I enjoyed them. The films, however, stay
are
too
awful.
Yeah, they stay
awful.
Way too close to the book. Each film, one after the other, is more boring than the next, frankly.
I totally agree. They're awful.
Well, if you don't like the previous ones, you're not going to like this even – you're going to like this even less, because this one is more faithful to the books. The last movies, they've always made strong decisions about what to cut because they have to cut and condense. This one, they sort of didn't cut anything. And so the buzz from some of the people who saw the screenings earlier in the day was, oh, boy, it's long. You know, these are not hardcore Harry Potter fans, but they were still like, oh, man, that was a long movie. So this could be your least favorite of all.
Well, we were just talking about Black Ops a few minutes ago, and it dawned on me while I was looking at all these numbers that these numbers are interesting. You got box office figures. They take into account the gross. And it looks like with video games, they're taking into account the gross. And I agree with you, Michael. These video games will drop like a rock in the next couple of weeks. They won't be earning as much as they did in the first 5 to 10 days. But with books and with albums, you do not have a financial figure to go with the number of units sold, which I've always found interesting.
That's true. And with Taylor Swift, when she sold 1 million copies, if 30% of them were sold at $4 a pop digitally via Amazon, which was their sale price, that obviously would lower the gross tremendously.
Right. And that's what I'm referring to. And we can talk about that maybe with Joe Fleischer a little later on. But we should probably get into some movie news. And unfortunately, we have some sad news. Dino De Laurentiis, whose name I continue to mispronounce.
De Laurentiis.
De Laurentiis, I think.
It is. And I don't know why I'm butchering his name, because, of course, you know, I know him as the producer of Dune.
That's right. And David Lynch spoke at his funeral. A lot of celebrities were there. Arnold Schwarzenegger, David Lynch. I mean, Dino De Laurentiis is an old school Hollywood producer. He did Highbrow. He did Lowbrow. He did Middlebrow. I mean, he would do a remake of King Kong and look like he was shooting for the moon, and it would be kind of trashy. He would do Orca, you know, sort of a silly
movie. He did Orca?
Movie.
That's a great movie.
And then he'd follow that around with stuff like
Ragtime,
Conan the Barbarian, which was a good film series, The Dead Zone, which was one of the best film adaptations of Stephen King. You know, he was just all over the map, a really colorful, you know, fascinating guy who did everything you can imagine in the film world.
I was going to say, I was a little bit more sad, though, at the passing of Jill Clayburgh, such a wonderful character actress.
Yeah, no, she's a terrific actress. She got a lot of attention. Her daughter, Lily Rabe, is acting on Broadway right now. She's in The Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino, which is excellent. Go see it if you can. And suddenly they delayed the opening, and they just said she had personal reasons and nobody quite knew why. And then suddenly, of course, we found out that her mom had died, and we realized why she was out of the show. So that was, you know, very sad to hear. But, you know, An Unmarried Woman, some other great films. She's, you know, she was an Oscar nominee, a very good talent.
Well, and Dino De Laurentiis, how's that?
Good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, he won two Oscars in the 50s for Fellini's La Strada. And then I guess without telling Fellini, he went and recut one of his other films and won another Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. And I'm trying to look
Knights up. Of Cabiria.
Yeah, he like re-edited it and won an Oscar.
That's fascinating. I wonder if the edit that he did is the one we know or whether
I believe Fellini- it is.
Oh, really? Wow, that's a great movie.
Yeah, and of course, he produced other great movies, Serpico, Death Wish, 3 Days of the Condor. So yeah, you're right, Michael. He was kind of known for producing these highbrow films, but then incredibly cheesy lowbrow films.
Well, you know, Dino De Laurentiis changed the rules of movie producing. He was a high roller, a gambler, and he shook up the industry. And obviously now Big Champagne wants to shake up the music industry with its new chart metric, the ultimate chart.
Yes, and that is the new music chart, which wants to challenge the iconic Billboard Hot 100 as the real measure of an artist's success. And Billboard includes a mix of radio play and song sales to determine the hottest singles in the country. But a new competitor, Big Champagne, and its ranking system, the Ultimate Chart, as you mentioned, Michael, say that's not enough. What about YouTube plays? What about streaming audio? What about tweets on Twitter, hits on and fans on Facebook? The Ultimate Chart launched in July of this year, and it combines all sorts of social media to determine not just the best-selling single of the week or the songs getting the most airplay on traditional radio, but the hottest songs and artists of the week. Joining us to discuss Big Champagne and the Ultimate Chart is the company's chief marketing officer, Joe Fleischer. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Now, one of the reasons we wanted to speak with you was because a couple of weeks back, we ran across an article titled, How Lady Gaga's 1 Billion YouTube Views Changes the Music Industry. In the article, which was on Fast Company, you said the moment served as, quote, a wake-up call for the industry and that we need to think about the metrics of success differently. Can you explain how Big Champagne is measuring music metrics in a way that sets it apart from existing measurement systems?
Sure. I mean, specifically, and when we talk about Lady Gaga, what really struck us was that I think probably we are undervaluing artists and songs and their successes in the industry if we're only looking at things like sales metrics and airplay, because there's with so much more choice for the consumer in ways that they can consume or interact or engage with music, it really is important to keep in mind that there is a consistency of popularity that somebody like Lady Gaga or Taylor Swift really personify. And what I mean by that is when an album debuts, say on the Billboard album chart, or really anything that's just measuring those sales, and during that week, there's sort of a false impression that that's the most popular artist during that time. But that it's really not true. There's really no point where an artist like, you know, not to pick, but somebody like a Disturbed who may have debuted very high is really going to be more popular than Lady Gaga. That's just not the case. And so it's important to think about that distortion that has been created that sort of falsely allocates marketing and promotion resources and kind of forgets that the consumer is engaged even when the artist is not in a product cycle. And so what we set out to do with the Ultimate Chart is try to give voice to that and try to do a better job of keeping track of popularity consistently throughout time and really look at what's happening in addition to those sales, you know, those on-demand actions that somebody takes at a YouTube or a MySpace are incredibly critical and really indicative of demand. You know, the search activity around an artist is indicative of demand. And so just looking at transactions, though they are heavily weighted in our chart because they are where the artist sees the most remuneration or the content owner, you know, gets paid the most, we just really felt it was critical to do a really more accurate, consistent measurement. And I'd really like to see, you know, we talked about this a little bit in that Fast Company piece. I think I'd like to see the RIAA step up and look at how to award gold and platinum status a little bit differently, because I think we're looking at a real paucity of those awards, and I don't think there's enough recognition for success right now.
Well, now you talk about transactions and the number of whether it's albums sold or airplays, but can you talk a little bit about Big Champagne's history? Because I have known you, I guess, since 2003, maybe even earlier, but you started as a company that tracked illegal peer-to-peer sharing. And so was it hard to win over the music industry, given that really what you were and still are measuring in part was the popularity of pirated material?
And as an addendum to that, when did you first realize the importance of social media and measuring something like this?
A great question. And the answer to that is it kind of depends on the moment in time you look at where Big Champagne is. When Big Champagne arrives on the scene in 2000, the initial response to us was, hey, that's great. Thank God somebody is looking at this Napster issue and has a read on it, because we really set out to track the first iteration of digital music. And as you guys know, there really wasn't any legitimate digital music until the emergence of the iTunes Music Store in 2003, which is, I think, what you're talking about when you first kind of see us really emerge. That's also the year that we pacted with Clear Channel and Mediabase, which is a spin tracking company, to model the search and download activities around P2P in relationships to what radio stations play in different markets. And that became a very popular research tool for programmers to understand what they should play more, play less. Still hundreds of stations use it, just in its P2P form. But at some point, the industry became very focused on jawboning or messaging that they had the piracy issue under control. And as silly as all that would sound now, at the time, I don't think people in the mainstream press certainly didn't, I don't think, understand the nuances of technology and that was an implausible claim. It wasn't untruthful. It just wasn't, if you really looked at it in terms of could you actually blunt file trading on the internet, well, now we know, of course, that's not the case. But it was a very hard message to hear. And we kept trying to promote that message because we were of the opinion that the industry would not be able to resuscitate itself and to really embrace some of the harder things it would have to do in terms of embracing the consumer and meeting the consumer halfway digitally. And so that produced a very difficult time for us, where we essentially were saying to our, you know, colleagues and people that we have had a good history working with in the content industry, you guys don't have pirates under control. You need to step up the availability of digital options. That was a difficult period. But about the time that more services began to emerge and the industry understood that we were tracking literally everything, and we just wanted to help them through this time and get them to a place where they were really making good business intelligence decisions, the mood changed almost overnight. And we're now, you know, certainly very much back in favor, and I think a big part of the solution.
And when, as Karen said, did you say, gee, we need to look at all these hits on YouTube, look at the comments on Twitter, we need to track this as well and start tracking impressions and not just sales?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question too, because that was the case was, I think, until probably about 2007, the calculus made by a major label on their digital marketing was, that's great, we got some plays at YouTube and MySpace, but did it lead to selling the shiny disc? And what we were trying to get across to them at that point was, guys, I don't really think that you're going to see something truly causative. You're looking at some things that are indeed what you feared, that they are replacement behaviors. And we need you guys to be focused. You need to get paid on YouTube streams. You need to get paid on MySpace streams. You need to be paid literally anywhere that somebody is acquiring your content. Now, these deals, as you know, are not as financially rewarding as buying a 10-song package on plastic.
Well, actually, it's funny that you should mention that. And I know, Michael, you have a question about the charts themselves, but I read this week that 75% of Topspin sales involve physical goods. And Topspin is kind of, I don't know what you would call it, but it helps music artists, I guess, put their presence on the web. And so, for instance, I recently purchased an Elvis Costello album. And in the end, it looked as if I was purchasing it from the Elvis Costello website, but I was really buying it from Topspin. So they're kind of a back office solution for a lot of musicians. What they say is 50% of what they sell is digital, and 50% of it contains something physical. And the 50% that contains something physical is 75% of their revenue. So those little shiny discs actually make more money.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. In terms of what Topspin does, which is a really pioneering direct-to-fan model, they're engaging the most high-value customer for those artists. They have the best touch point, which they measure out as email. And those are exactly the types of folks who are going to invest in the artist and buy the highest value item. In fact, not just the ordinary CDs, but as you pointed out, special packages and signatures and things that are even more experiential around the physical product. So that's a great model. But when you look at the way Lady Gaga is consumed, and Lady Gaga by volume is consumed at a much higher rate than Elvis Costello, obviously, a lot of that is digital. Whereas somebody like Elvis Costello, the audience engages it in a little bit of a different way. But those giant mainstream artists, physical doesn't make up as much of a portion of the pie as the labels would prefer. And so it's critical that they understand exactly what's happening with all of the on-demand. And so to answer your question, when did we see that? I would say almost immediately. We think, though, there may be a bit of a bubble in the emphasis that's on social in terms of focusing too much on maybe how many fans or thinking that those will be directly correlative to real conversion. That's probably not the case. Social is a great, great marketing tool, but where there are transactions and social, like at YouTube and MySpace, I think that's really critical.
But what about measuring sentiment on social?
Sentiment is important too. You know, we work with a company called We Are Hunted, which is just one of my favorite music and charting companies. They're a great technology.
That is a great site. I don't know how they do what they do, but it is a great website.
You should talk to them. They're fascinating people, and they have really, I think, done some good work on exactly what you're talking about in sentiment tracking. Now, I will say that it's difficult to utilize a lot of machine learning technology in determining if commentary is positive or negative, and how to appropriate value it, when even human beings faced with that same task often can't. But I think We Are Hunted does by far the best work on that sort of sentiment. And that helps you understand how somebody's feeling about a track, or your audience is feeling about a track or feeling about an artist, but it's not necessarily causative in terms of what they're going to do with their hard-earned money. It's still an important indicator, like a brand would use.
Now, what you say makes a lot of sense. And when I heard about the Ultimate Chart, I was kind of really excited thinking about, oh, they're going to pull in YouTube and they're going to pull in all these different things and start tracking popularity of the way people consume music today. And that was really exciting. And it brought me back to Billboard. And when they changed their album charts to SoundScan, they used to just have record stores report what their best-selling albums were. And they were rock and pop stars over and over again, week after week. When they started tracking what people were actually buying, literally point-of-sale purchases, suddenly you would have country artists debuting in the top 10. You'd have hip-hop artists. You'd have gospel albums in the top 20. And it blew people's minds. They realized what people were actually consuming, and it turned people like Garth Brooks into superstars and really changed the industry dramatically. So I was looking forward to this chart and thinking, wow, I'm going to see things I'm not seeing before. Artists are going to pop up. And so far, I have to say that your charts are very similar to the Billboard charts. And I'm sure you're going to be working on the formula, you know, week after week and month after month and tweaking it. But right now, if you look at your top 10 singles, you have Rihanna and Keisha, Far East Movement, Another Rihanna, Katy Perry, Willow Smith, Pink, Nelly, Bruno Mars, and Eminem. The Billboard top 10 charts is Rihanna, Far East Movement, Bruno Mars, Another Rihanna, Keisha, Nelly, Pink, Trey Songz, Usher, and Katy Perry. Basically the same songs in roughly the same order. The two artists that are on each chart that aren't on the other one are on the other chart's top 20 list. So I'm wondering about the similarity there and how you're tweaking the formula to try and capture the difference of what's going on as far as YouTube and all these other impressions.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I mean, when you look at what we're doing with the Ultimate Chart, it's less tweaking the formula. It's more adding iterations to the data values. And what I mean by that is what you'll see from us coming soon is a country-only chart. So the Ultimate Country Chart is coming very soon. You're going to see a DIY chart that really gives voice to those artists that haven't really been given a proper venue or a really proper accounting of their success. So you're going to see it surface. You're going to see those charts surface some things that you really wouldn't see anywhere else.
Well, you mean like the bubbling under on Billboard 200 or their country charts? I mean, how is that different?
Yeah, no, the country charts. I mean, I think that the country charts will have a lot of similarities too. But again, we do measure some things differently. So there will be some variations. And for instance, even in the Ultimate Chart, which is really the 100 most popular artists and songs, there are occurrences of things on our chart that you really don't get on the Billboard chart. For instance, the Bedroom Intruder song, Antoine Todson, really didn't have a vehicle or a way to chart on a traditional chart without us. And it's done very well and hung around for a very long time, even though it's really ignored by traditional broadcast. The CeeLo Green track, due to its content, rose a lot faster with us and made it to a higher point on the chart, I believe, based really on the fact that there's just so much excitement around CeeLo on YouTube. So there are cuts that emerge with us faster, get higher with us, and there are some things that we do have, even though they may not make it into the top 10. It's hard for Antoine Dodson, who is sort of an accidental star, to compete with the Rihannas and the Katies and the Kesha's of the world. But there actually are some variations in our chart from the Billboard Hot 100. And the funny thing is if I think there was any more variation, I think that we would be getting claims that this chart is somehow not calculating correctly because it's too different. You know, it's always the catch 22 you're in when you're trying to model something when there has been a longstanding sort of report card.
Well, now the CEO of Big Champagne, Eric Garland, kind of said at the New Music Seminar that YouTube may very well be more important than iTunes in terms of measuring success.
Well, I think what he's talking about is in sheer volume, YouTube is just massive. I mean, as big as iTunes is, when you look at transactions, and it's clearly, in terms of legitimate downloads, there's really only iTunes. It's the only game in town. But when you look at the way people consume music, if you count things like online, on-demand streaming, and you count P2P, it's not as large. And so I think what he's really saying is as huge and as valuable as iTunes is, there are other venues that are also producing these enormous numbers.
And in fact, right now you're focusing on legitimate parts of the industry, iTunes, YouTube, Twitter, etc. But you continue to chart illegal downloads in a separate service called TopSwaps. Why do you do it separately, and does the industry still kind of find that to be a little irksome?
Yes. The reason we chart it separately is a couple of reasons. The Ultimate Chart is a revenue-bearing chart, and we wanted it to reflect that. So when you look at even our inclusion of social and fans, friends, and followers, those are modifiers of the ways that an artist is actually paid. P2P doesn't have any transactional value, and according to which economist you're you're most swayed by, a lot of it is cannibalization and replacement. So that is why it isn't included in the ultimate chart. There is a plan to do a little more with some of that data because people are still so fascinated by it, and of course radio still lives on it. But we keep it separate because it really is a separate thing. It behaves differently. If you use our Ultimate Chart Pro, which is what the content companies and the broadcast companies use to chart all of these disparate types of data in sort of a Bloomberg terminal interface environment, we call those things out separately because they behave differently. P2P has the gift of really telling you about demand as well as what people are downloading. And so it has a nice little effect for companies that are looking at playing really the most popular stuff of the moment, just like you would in watching YouTube or MySpace. So it's a leading indicator.
Well, certainly, Joe, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about Big Champagne. And where can people go? TheUltimateChart.com is one place where they can go. I imagine you're on Twitter as well.
We are, yes. You can definitely sign up for our Twitter feed or the blog. If you go to bigchampagne.com, all of that stuff is there. You can use our free news feed there, which is called Breaking News, and that will tell you about all kinds of things that are happening in the industry all the time. And so if you're plugged into that with our Twitter feed, our blog feed, and that, you're really plugged into what's happening in the music industry. And of course, be sure to keep going to ultimatechart.com as we release new iterations of the chart over the next few months, including market-based charts. So we'll do like Ultimate Dallas and Ultimate Chicago.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Of course, anytime, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that was an interesting thing. I think they need to be a little bolder. I mean, if you really track like Lady Gaga's popularity, she'd be like at the top of the charts for 6-8 months in a row. And I think their chart now is a little too traditional.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. However, what's not traditional is country music. At least some of the artists that are making news in country music.
Did I totally watch the awards? Did you guys?
Yes.
Yes.
And I loved it.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable. They had, I think...
We're talking about the Country Music Awards, which is the country's big night on television.
Oh, yeah. Did we not say that? I guess...
We did say that. Sorry. Which was on, last Tuesday?
Tuesday, I believe. Yeah, Tuesday or Wednesday. And the hosts were Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood, the king and queen of country music.
However, it was a new, I guess, the prince and princess of country music that took over the show. Miranda Lambert and...
Blake Shelton.
Blake Shelton, yeah. And they won... 6 awards, I think.
And they both, it was his and hers for best female, best male recording artist. I mean,
they're dating. They're the lovebirds of Nashville. The New York Times bizarrely described Miranda Lambert as an unlikely winner, which is insane.
What? She's a front runner. What are they talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Miranda Lambert has had 3 number one albums in a row, debut at number one in country music. The Times itself has profiled her as a huge breakout star. She writes almost all her own music. She plays guitar. She took control of her career. She's country as it gets. She's just been a huge star for 5 years in the world of country music. She was definitely the front runner. So why they describe her as unlikely is beyond me.
Well, didn't she win some contest, or was that Blake
Shelton? No, she was the third runner up on Nashville Star, which was a really great reality show talent competition that's just been canceled, I found out. And she was the third runner up when she should have won that first season. She would have given it great legitimacy like Kelly Clarkson did to American Idol. She then went out and she toured and toured and toured and toured and toured. And then when her debut album, she was recording her debut album and she thought the producers were rushing it out and making it too country pop. And she walked out and she said no. And she just walked away and refused to do it until they would let her have more control and make the album she wanted. And when she did, and after doing so much touring, it debuted at number one and it blew everybody's mind. They were like, what? Who is this? And that just launched her career 5 years ago in 2005. The album was Kerosene. And she's been going from strength to strength and getting better to better every album. Revolution is her latest. It came out last year, one of my favorite albums of the year. And the song that won Song of the Year, The House That Made Me, is just as country as it gets. I don't think she actually wrote
that. The House That Built Me, I believe.
The House That Built Me. She didn't actually write that song, but it was a great pick, and it's a classic country tune. And it's a very good album.
It was originally offered to Blake Shelton, and then she asked if she could record it instead, and so he essentially gave it to her.
And then they said, let's go out on a date.
is that how they met?
No, no, I don't believe that.
That would be amazing. Hey, I was saw you across the bar. I've got this song I wrote that I think you'd
but
be
like,
perfect.
But like,
somebody else wrote it.
But still, I mean.
But like all award shows, what matters are the performances. Karen, what did you think of Taylor Swift's performance?
You know, for Taylor Swift, I thought it was great.
I agree.
I thought it was very measured. It was incredibly measured, and she did not get up from her piano, and she just kind of...
That's what I mean. For Taylor Swift, it was great.
What song did she sing? It was something about December. Back to December, she sang. And you could tell she was really struggling to hit some of those notes, but she pulled it off in the end.
Michael, is that the one that's about Taylor Lautner?
I don't remember.
You know, I guess they hand out like 9 awards and there are twice as many performances. And it is a really well-produced show. And this year, I think the big news out of the show was not made by a musician, but was made by Gwyneth Paltrow, who was joined by Vince Gill for a live performance of a song that she recorded for an upcoming movie, Country Strong. And she did a great job. And many people said, you know what, Vince Gill was there to back her up, but he really did not need to be.
They promoted this throughout the entire show, but I don't think that this was the pinnacle moment of the show. I thought she did a great job, but I wasn't surprised. We already know from her duet with Huey Lewis from, what, 4 years ago, that she could sing.
Like a decade ago.
Oh, wow, I'm old.
Well, the unofficial YouTube video of Paltrow's performance on the CMAs racked up 2 million page views relatively quickly. Now, here's the interesting part. The official YouTube video of Taylor Swift's performance had less than 100,000 views.
Oh, that's meaningless. You know, I think Gwyneth Paltrow had the, you know, what did she do? Did she fall on her face? I don't think she was great, but I thought she was good. She was a little struggling on the high notes, but she did better than the typical Taylor Swift performance. And it was, you know, she was admirable. She didn't embarrass herself. She wasn't, oh my God, this is a new worldwide talent, but she was good.
Yeah, you could tell she was nervous.
Oh, yeah.
Well, remember, she's married to Chris Martin of Coldplay. So it's not like she, you know, she's got some kind of home training, so to speak. And
that's
had
right. Maybe her husband
he
gave her.
That he gave her no training whatsoever because he didn't have time.
Oh, that's very funny. That's,
that's a husband.
Yeah, I was going to say nice of him.
It's a big musical week for Gwyneth. Obviously, we're taping on a Tuesday and tonight she's on Glee. But the video of her performing the CeeLo song Forget You, to put it in its polite terms, is already up online and getting lots of hits as well.
I know, and New York Magazine said, it is great. The silliest, the cheesiest, the most cornball dance movie-est, the how many faces can one person pull in less than 3 minutes-est, but also it is the bestiest. Over the next few months, we may have occasion to recategorize this period as just a blip, but the last 2 days have laid a solid foundation for the Gwyneth Paltrow personality redemption tower. My question is, when did Gwyneth Paltrow have to start rebuilding her career?
You mean back up?
She's incredibly unlikable, I think. I used to be a big fan, but somewhere, gosh, where was it? Like when she did the Stewardess movie, maybe?
That was a bad movie.
What was that called? On Top or something? Somewhere around there, she became incredibly unlikable.
Interesting. Well, I think when she named her baby Apple, maybe? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, the Stewardess movie is called View from the Top, but she was in Iron Man, which was an Iron Man 2, which were very big hits. She had a small role, but it helped her, you know, her cred come back again. She made a number of movies that just didn't do very well, like Running with Scissors and Proof, Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow, Sylvia, View from the Top,
yeah,
Possession. You know, she hasn't had a good movie in quite a while, either commercially or critically.
Yeah, I think people stopped liking her when she blubbered on stage about her Grandpa Buster in that ill-fitting pink dress when she won her Oscar for Shakespeare in Love.
Oh,
that was
her best moment. but after that, she had successes like The Royal Tannenbaums and, you know, Shallow Hal to a degree, and, you know, so she was still chugging along. But then she just made a lot of movies that didn't do very well, and that's just not very good. You got to be in good movies. They have to at least be critical favorites if they're not going to be commercial hits. And she wasn't doing either for a while. But, you know, she's funny on Glee, it looks like.
Did you like that clip from Glee? Because I'll tell you,
it was goofy.
A lot of people are kind of trashing it and saying, oh, well, you know, it's over the top, it's kind of goofy. And I'm looking at it and thinking to myself, how is that any more over the top than any of the other musical numbers that appear on Glee?
Yeah, it's totally appropriate. But there you go. People always like to trash anything online.
Well,
but
it's very
anyways,
easy.
But of course, that brings us to television. And you've all heard the news by now. A show debuted on basic cable to massive ratings, instant success, and became a pop culture phenomenon. No, I'm not talking about the zombie show on AMC, The Walking Dead.
Conan,
which is
Conan.
A big hit.
It was Conan.
No, not Conan. Even bigger hit than Conan, the Disney Channel's new hit series, Shake It Up.
What is that?
It's like American Dreams, that show about a girl joining American Bandstand. It's sort of the modern equivalent of that. It's about two teenage girls who join a dance show. You know, you go on the show and you dance like MTV used to have or American Bandstand in the old days. It's basically they're like, how can we do, you know, Dancing with the Stars crossed with High School Musical? And they came up with this show called Shake It Up. And it debuted last Sunday to 6.2 million viewers, more than The Walking Dead's 5.3 million. It was preceded by Hannah Montana, which hit 7.1 million viewers, which was the biggest audience since Following High School Musical in 2007. So it's just a, you know, out of the box hit. It's set in Chicago on a music show called Shake It Up Chicago, and the two girls, you know, get in goofy plot twists, and then they go dance on the show. It's Hannah Montana meets Dancing with the Stars.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and of course it got no attention because it's a kid's show.
You know what got no attention also, and we kind of skipped over it as well, was the Latin Grammy Awards. But I think we have to skip over it, unfortunately, only due to time.
Well, I think the act that won Big Camilla is so awful. It just proves that, you know, the real Grammy Awards have no lock on, you know, bland, you know, superstar talent that nobody actually really likes. Camilla is just a dreadful band.
Well, speaking of bland superstar talents that nobody really likes, Sarah Palin in Alaska also debuted to 4.96 million total viewers. So it was like the biggest debut of a Learning Channel show in their history.
I attempted to watch this.
You attempted to watch it?
Yeah, how was it?
It was awful. And first of all, if it had been about Alaska, which I actually find kind of an interesting place, then that would have been one thing, but it wasn't. This was the Palin reality show. I had to turn it off. I couldn't stand it.
Well, now that we've pissed off all of our Tea Party listeners.
Yeah, they're not listening at all. And of course, it was the highest debut for a TLC show, but it's not the highest rated TLC show ever. John and Kate Plus 8 hit a peak of about 10 million viewers when that they were going through their tabloid craziness.
Well, I'm sure NBC wishes they could get that many viewers. They decided to shake up their mid-season schedule. They renewed 30 Rock early. Normally, that comes at the end of the season. They decided to do it before New Year's. Why not? So we'll get another season of 30 Rock. And then on Thursday, they're going to put six comedies back to back. So they're basically wiping out Thursday with comedy. And they hope to, I guess, win that one day. They're starting from that one day, and I guess they'll build outwards.
Well, they're not going to win. They're in fourth place on Thursdays. And six sitcoms in a row has never, ever worked and never will.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of comedy. But wouldn't you be interested to watch a 30 Rock at 10 o'clock? You know how dirty they could get?
Oh, good
well,
point.
If that changed the show, that is an interesting – that's a good point, that they could spice it up a bit, and maybe they'll like that freedom.
Speaking of freedom, Conan O'Brien has some freedom now, it seems, now that he's not with NBC. Things didn't work out for him there, and now he's on TBS. His show premiered on November 8th, last Monday, and rounded up 4.2 million total viewers.
Does this surprise us?
No, not at all.
And if you look at the track for the rest of the week, it's settling down. He hasn't plateaued or he hasn't leveled out yet. He's dropped from 4.16 million to 2.81 million on Tuesday to 2.72 million on Wednesday to 2.02 million on Thursday. Hopefully he'll stabilize at some point right around 2 million because they don't want to keep bleeding viewers. But that's what you would expect, a ton of attention for their debut show. And then you drop, you know, heavily down until you find where your level is. And he hasn't quite found it yet. He dropped 700,000 viewers from Wednesday to Thursday last week. So we'll have to see what the numbers are this week.
That's only traditional Nielsen, right? I mean, we don't know how many people are watching him online.
Well, we're gonna assume that just as many people would do it as if they were watching him on NBC. On, you know, that those added viewers probably haven't changed. I doubt for any reason that suddenly he's getting an extra 2 million viewers online. That wouldn't make any sense. So, yeah, they'll have more viewers with DVR playback and online. But
well, if he falls below 1.9 million viewers, then he will fall below The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which gets about that. And The Daily Show, the average age for that show is about 38. And for The Tonight Show, it's kind of up 15, there. It's 59. Yeah. And Letterman is 53. And I don't mean he is 53. That's the average age. For Conan, it's 30. And that's really important because it's a lot easier to sell to advertisers when your audience is a younger demo.
Well, what did you guys think of his show? Did you watch him?
Yes.
I saw the first one. It's typical him. I thought I find him funny, and that's what he was.
But he was so nervous. I mean, for God's sakes, he's been doing this for 18 years or whatever, and he still seems like he's got the jitters. Well, he seems so overhyped on that, so overamped on that first show, and he's still not a very good interviewer. And how many decades does he have to do this before he relaxes into the role?
I find his manic energy really rather soothing in a weird way.
Oh, okay.
You know, I have a funny Conan O'Brien story. When I was first moving to Los Angeles, it was 1992, somewhere in there. And I was, running around studio lots with my resume, fresh out of film school. And, hire me, hire me. Apparently, I had a higher voice back then. And so I would just knock on anybody's door. And there I was on the Fox lot, and I saw the Gracie Films office, the production office. And I thought, well,
that's James L. Brooks, right?
James L. Brooks. And of course, he is one of the producers on The Simpsons, which, by the way, was picked up for a 23rd season. I decided, since I knew that they produced The Simpsons, I would go and knock on their door. And so I went and knocked on a door that said The Simpsons on it. I thought, well, okay, it's not only James L. Brooks' production company, but it says The Simpsons right on the door. And so I knocked on the door and asked, if I could speak with somebody who might be able to hire me. And there were two very nice young men in the office right there on the Fox lot. They said that they were writers for The Simpsons. And they talked to me for a while, and as I was talking to them, I thought, my God, this guy is really tall and his hair is really a little bright. Well, of course, that person turned out to be Conan O'Brien. I didn't know it at the time, but that's who it was.
Did he touch you?
I don't know where that came from, but
was it inappropriate? Yeah.
No, he did take my resume and he said, look, we can't help you at all. I mean, and they were very funny and about like, why am I knocking on their door? Are they kidding? They're just writers. They found it very funny. I, on the other hand, was scared of the very tall man with the red hair.
Well, speaking of writers, there's some news in the book world very quickly. Ebook readers continue to sell at a hot pace. This time last year, about 3.7 million people had purchased an ebook reader like the Kindle, the iPad, which hadn't quite come out yet, or the Nook and the other Sony reader. This year now, we're well over 10 million units sold, including the iPad. The iPad is by far and away the biggest one. They expect it to be a massively big hit on Black Friday. They think the ebook readers are going to really take off. And to reflect that, the New York Times has announced that they're going to add a new chart. They have a hardcover chart, a paperback chart. And now they're going to have an ebook chart and show the ebook bestsellers, because often they're kind of radically different than the charts in the other areas. So that'll hopefully reflect what people are purchasing. And of course, I'm sure they will meld in those ebook sales into their ultimate chart, because the ultimate chart into their final chart, because they can't cut out a third of book sales. They're not going to keep it separate. They're going to have to meld those into their main chart sales figures down the road.
Well, yeah, the prediction from the industry, the publishing industry, is that sales will rise to about 25% of all books sold over the next 2 to 3 years.
That's unbelievable.
I guess this year they've already sold 1 billion ebooks. It's the first year they've sold 1 billion ebooks in 1 year.
A billion? No, they haven't.
Maybe it's $1 billion worth of... Yeah, it's a bill. Sorry. I take that all back. It's a billion dollars worth of ebooks.
So that's like 5%. That's 5% of the business. That's a lot for such a new format.
So then you're saying it's a big deal.
I am.
Segway alert.
Thank you very much, Karen. I count on you for letting everybody know that we are headed into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Now, this first story is so big that it's taken over the entire front page of Apple's website. The Beatles come to iTunes. After years of holding out, the best-selling band of all time, indeed the second best-selling act of the 2000s after Eminem, despite breaking up decades earlier, has finally agreed to sell its songs digitally on iTunes. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is such a big deal. It's about time.
I couldn't agree more. It is a big deal. It's symbolic and important for them not to hold out anymore. But it drives me nuts that the New York Times, in their story, overstate the sales of Beatle albums in the U.S. by 40 million albums because they don't know how Billboard does its charts.
Well, what's 40 million albums between friends?
Exactly.
Cable channel AMC is enjoying the biggest hit it ever had with the zombie drama The Walking Dead. So that may take the sting out of canceling its paranoid thriller Rubicon after just one season, even though when it premiered, it was the highest rated series debut in AMC's history. At least they're willing to call it a day quicker than HBO, which often seems to stick with duds for two or more seasons before admitting defeat. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop in the grand scheme of things for AMC. They're just going from strength to strength, and you can't get a home run every time at bat.
Yeah, I agree. Week show gets canceled.
Well, does that mean I should delete the 8 episodes of Rubicon I have on my TiVo, or should I watch them?
I would delete it.
To get through and rather boring, so up to you.
If you can't use Mel Gibson in your movie, how about former President Bill Clinton? He's not playing the same role that Mel was cast in and then uncast in, but apparently Bill Clinton has filmed a cameo in The Hangover 2. We would have put him in a Harold and Kumar movie, but you can't have everything, can you? Karen, is seeing a president do a cameo in an R-rated raunchy comedy a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it depends on the context, but I'm going to have to say that I think this is sort of a big deal because I think it's sort of disgusting, but I mean, at least it's not Obama, but it depends on the context.
Michael, what about you?
I was going to say a big whoop, but I think Karen has sort of won me over as far as the tawdriness of this, so I think she may be right.
If someone can shoot a movie on their iPhone, there's no reason why Damon Albarn of Gorillaz can't record an album on his iPad. That's what the former leader of Blur has done. He fell in love with his iPad, recorded a new Gorillaz record to follow up Plastic Beach, which only came out earlier this year, in March, and in the 2.0 world we live in, he wants to release it by Christmas. Karen, what band was Albarn in before Gorillaz, and is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Didn't you just say he was in Blur?
Yeah.
I messed that up.
Interesting deal. I don't know if I would call it a big deal. I'm also in love with my iPad, and I think it's interesting that he recorded an album on his iPad.
I want to know, what app did he use for that? Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. I don't care if he records it on a kazoo, as long as it's good.
George Bush invaded two countries, one of them based on claims that have fallen apart under close examination. He turned an annual budget surplus into an annual deficit and exploded the national debt. He helped Wall Street collapse into ruin, saw two major car companies teeter on the brink of bankruptcy, and, oh yes, watched passively as an entire American city was swallowed up by floodwaters. But apparently, the worst moment of his presidency was when rapper Kanye West spontaneously said, "George Bush doesn't care about black people," on national TV during a charity drive for New Orleans. West went on the Today Show to apologize, but was thrown off when the show's producers played footage of him being an ass at the Grammys. And actually, it wasn't the Grammys, it was the MTV Video Music Awards. He chided Lauer and later canceled a performance on the news show. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I say it's a big deal. I think Kanye was actually right. He can be egotistical and crazy, but I did think it was pointless and silly of them to show that Taylor Swift footage when, in the context of what they were doing. They had Bush on live to accept his apology. It was just tacky and inappropriate.
Stories going on here, but yeah, Kanye West came on to apologize, and you don't need to be putting up footage of something that he has already apologized for and moved on from.
Remember Metallica? That's the warning Kiss might want to keep in mind when it got all corporate and said that fans who were stealing their music deserved to be put in jail. People got angry and someone blocked the website GeneSimmons.com just for a little while. Now Simmons, the band's bassist, says, "Cute, hope you enjoy your time in prison, because we are going to track you down and put you in jail." Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Just because you do something online doesn't mean it's like a prank and playful and cute. You're blocking the guy's website that his fans can access. That should be a crime, and they should be punished. He's absolutely right.
Well, I find it interesting, too, that, I mean, I don't think I disagree with you, Michael, but I find it interesting that any musician who wants to be paid for their work is somehow uncool.
Exactly.
So big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
If you don't like him, don't go to his website, don't buy his music. You know, badmouth him on your own website, but don't attack the way he reaches out to people online. It's not cool.
And don't attack Phil Collins. He is tired of being kicked around. The pop star, who was one of the biggest acts in the world during the 80s, is really hurt. And when he's the butt of jokes in websites like I Hate Phil Collins, and right after his new album comes out, he just might stop altogether. Collins is physically incapable of holding a drumstick anymore and has a damaged neck that would prevent him from playing them anyway. He's considered suicide, but loves his kids too much. After this album of Motown covers, he may just stay close to home, poring over his collection of historical memorabilia from the Alamo. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm afraid that if I don't say this is a big, very important deal, he's going to kill himself.
Well, I'll go with Karen. It's sort of, you know, the spiraling down of a once huge star. It's sad that he can get so wound up by online comments and slurs. But he's also talking about things like guys from Oasis saying, you know, you don't have to talent. You don't have to have talent to be a big star. Look at Phil Collins, you know.
Collins is very talented. I don't understand where this is coming from.
He's incredibly talented.
He is talented. Well, he was mega successful, and he had sort of pop tunes that sort of felt disposable. Susu Studio was not a song I ever want to hear again. So I understand, but people sometimes forget that. Yeah, okay, you don't like his music, fine, but, you know, to belittle and mock him, you know, he's an actual real person, and this guy's really having a tough time physically, and it just reminds you that, you know, these are actual real people that you're slandering and mocking online, and you should think twice about it.
In really poor taste, the Rolling Stone interview, which is where all of this news came from, pictures him with a shotgun.
Yeah, well, he's got a sense of humor.
And actually, that is probably a gun from his Alamo collection. He is a Civil War memorabilia collector.
It's not Civil War. The Alamo is not the Civil War. The Alamo is entirely separate historical battle. But he's actually has photographs taken at the sites where the Alamo battle occurred and says, look at these glowing orbs. These are like presences of spirits from the beyond. A psychic told me that I was reincarnated. I'm not a nut like Shirley MacLaine, but I might just be reincarnated from one of the people who was there at the Alamo. I mean, he really is deep into this.
Rock Band, once the hottest video game in the market, is now for sale, and not at a video store. Viacom has cooled on the franchise and has put the games maker, Harmonix, up for sale. Viacom selling Rock Band maker Harmonix? Thank God Justin Bieber opted to put out his video game via TapTap and the iPhone. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Look how quickly a brand can get overextended and peter itself out.
Karen?
Big deal. Yeah, I agree.
At Showbiz Sandbox, we love Kristen Bell. We also love Veronica Mars. Studios keep putting Bell in romantic comedies that flop, but for some reason, Warner Brothers has yet to take the obvious step and make Veronica Mars into a movie, with Kristen Bell presumably headed off to college and solving mysteries every step of the way. But now Warner Brothers has responded to fans' requests, sort of. They've set up an email account, veronicamarsmovie@warnerbros.com, where you can send in your plea. Is that so Warner Brothers can delete them more easily? Or do they want to build up an email list they can blast with news when the movie is actually a go? Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's an interesting deal if they really mean what they say. I mean, if this is to set up an email account so that they can blast people when the movie is a go, or to see how many people are really interested in the movie, then I think this is a big deal. But if it's just somebody setting up an email account to get people off their back, then clearly it's a big whoop.
I say it's a medium deal. I do think it's an interesting way of responding to social media and the way all people want to contact a studio. And they say, all right, we're going to acknowledge that these people exist and that they're doing this. Let's set up an account so they know where to send it so we can put it all in one place.
Well, it might be their way of measuring it, too, that if they get 4 million emails, they go, let's make this movie.
And they don't want them going to this VP and that secretary and that whatever email address they can snap up. Give them an email they can send it to. At least it's a way of dealing with fans and letting them feel like they're not just shouting into the wilderness.
Rubik's Cube, the movie. Yes, Creative Artists Agency is now representing the film rights to the handheld puzzle Rubik's Cube. Who says Hollywood has run out of original ideas? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because I think Etch-A-Sketch has been holding out for an HBO miniseries, but, you know, Rubik's Cube is stepping up and saying they want to go the feature film route. I think Slinky and Lightbright and Sea Monkeys will probably follow in their wake.
Sea Monkeys, that's a show right
That's
there.
A film at least.
Yeah,
that's,
come on.
It's Avatar.
Yeah. Come on. Karen, what do you think?
This is bizarre.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop, and we'll move right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss only the news that Hollywood might care about. And this week, we're going to be discussing something I know that Karen and Michael both love, Hulu. Apparently, its CEO, Jason Kilar, boasted of 200 million $240 million in revenues and 30 million subscribers. But we're going to have to inform him what a subscriber is, because you actually have to pay money to subscribe. It's not just 30 million unique visitors, which is what it really is.
Right, and their revenue of $240 million is actually about only $80 million that Hulu gets to keep, since most of it goes off to the networks that provide them with their original programming. So this is Hulu saying, look how great we're doing. And when they got to their area about Hulu Plus subscribers, the people who are paying $10 a month, just like the Times of London, when they were talking about, oh, we've got all these people paying for our digital-only access, they didn't want to give you any numbers. They just say, oh, they're ahead of the plan as far as what they were hoping to have at this point. That means they're not doing very well, because if they had good numbers, they would tell you.
But that's kind of been Hulu's MO for a long time. Like they give you these numbers, and then you really kind of look at them, and you're like, well, but what is this really saying? And then they're like, trust us, we're doing well. And you're like, well, okay, but why?
Well, do you believe Killar when he says that ads on Hulu are 55% more effective than ads run in traditional channels? Okay.
And yeah, MediaWeek agrees about that. They say everybody loves the ad environment at Hulu. And I bring up MediaWeek because they had a story about Netflix, and Netflix is sort of moving into Hulu's territory. They got the rights from NBC to stream Saturday Night Live the day after it airs on NBC. And that's exactly what Hulu does. Hulu provides, you know, last week's episode online. And until now, nobody else has been playing that game, but now Netflix has been able to step in, and Hulu is reportedly furious, of course. Netflix has a much bigger reach, much bigger distribution channels. They got a lot better ways to reach people. They're writing big checks for programming, and now people are thinking, gee, Netflix can really step into Hulu's territory. And yet people also say Hulu and Netflix are so successful that the networks are going to keep thinking, why are we giving this material away just to get a piece of the ads? Why don't we do this ourselves? So people think Hulu's been so successful and is so tenuous, this weird sort of agreement between competitors to allow Hulu to exist, that it just can't survive long term.
Well, when you think about it, content is sold in four different ways. Transaction-based, and that's theatrically, so in the movie theater, and home video, so that's another transaction. You're paying money to rent and or own a movie or television show. And then there's premium pay TV, so that's like HBO. So in that regard, the content owner is getting money through a license. And then there's advertising-based. And what Hulu is advertising-based, and they're trying to go premium pay, but really, at the end of the day, what these content owners need is they need somebody to pay them for their content. And Netflix is paying them for their content. Therefore, Netflix will win and manage to get this content.
Right, because it's okay to sell ads and keep all the ad money like you do on the network. But when you're only getting a piece of the ads and you're letting Hulu do the same thing, there's no way you're going to make as much money. So if somebody's willing to pay you, you're going to go for them rather than just make an agreement and sharing the profits. You'd rather have someone pay you and give you a share of the profits.
Right.
But of course, Netflix doesn't have ads. They insist they don't want to do that. They like the model that they have right now.
Well, Karen, I know you have to jump. You have a meeting to attend, and we're running a little long. We're going to get on to listener email. Karen, thank you for joining us this week. Yes, we will actually, as promised, read listener email. We have two. I'm going to read one and save one for next week. The first one is from James. He says, "Dear Sandboxers, James the cinema buff here, writing from the United Kingdom, where we do indeed get The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I was listening to episode 78, where Michael and Karen were arguing over whether people get their news from The Daily Show. Well, there have been more than a few studies that show this to be true, and not so true. Whilst I have my own views on the matter," I love that, whilst, I love that use.
Whilst is a good word.
Yeah. "Whilst I have my own views on the matter, they are actually summed up pretty nicely by this selection from the show's Wikipedia entry." And he then quotes, "The show's writers reject the idea that The Daily Show has become a source of news for young people. Stewart argues that Americans are living in an age of information osmosis, in which it is close to impossible to gain one's news from any single source. And he says that his show succeeds comedically because the viewers already have some knowledge about current events. Our show," and this is a quote from Stewart, "our show would not be valuable to people who didn't understand the news because it wouldn't make sense. We make assumptions about your level of knowledge that if we were your only source of news, you would just watch our show and think, I don't know what's happening. Thanks for the great show. I listen every week and find it immensely informative. James. James, thank you for your email. And please, do subscribe on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. What do you think of that, Michael?
Well, I think I hinted at that argument. I felt like the show doesn't make sense unless you actually know the news already, and also that they only cover like three or four items of actual news in an episode. So I think it's silly to suggest they're getting their news from The Daily Show as such. It may be the only way they hear about things, but in that case, they're simply not getting news.
Yes, I think you should get your news, at least your entertainment news, from Showbiz Sandbox, which, as I just mentioned, you can subscribe to in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or your favorite RSS reader. You can find links to all of those places and to all of the news stories that we've discussed in today's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to past episodes, links to all of our social networking accounts like Facebook and Twitter and you name it. I mean, we've got all of them. Also at the website, you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, like James did. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to contact. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward has a website. It is karenwoodwardonline.com. She's also on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. If you want to look up Michael Giltz, his username is @MichaelGiltz, and his website is michaelgiltz.com, where you can find links to all of his writing. My Twitter username is @Sperling, and you can find some of my writing on the blog celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.